GXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
A mighty hard road that my poor hand is hold. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rolled, and your desert was hot and your mountains was cold. I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground in the light of your moon. On the edge of your city you've seen us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind. California and Arizona, I make all your crops, and it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine, to set on your table your light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that grand coulee dam where the water runs down. Ever stayed in this union, us migrants have been. We'll work in this fight and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble, that river and I, all along your green valley I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it be, 'cause my pastures of plenty must always be free.
Hello. Here we are on the Ag Show with Tess Diamond.
Hello.
That's her. I'm Elise McMahon, and we are lucky enough to be joined in this recording studio with the editors and creators of Modern Farmer Magazine. Do you guys want to say hi?
Hey.
Hello.
So we're here with Ray Hahn and Jake, and I think we're going to be joined by some other folks from their publication, and we'll be asking them questions. I know that they've been mysterious up there in that office above the Pilates studio in Hudson, New York. And they will be hitting the newsstands on April 15th, I understand. Is that right?
That 16th? Is right.
15th.
Well, 15th, yeah.
Okay, the 15th. So we will be getting into that interview for the second portion of this Ag Show today. But for now, we are going to do our regular thing where we talk a little bit about some jobs, some current jobs, in case you need to get paid for some really nice work outside. And then we will have some agricultural related news, and then we will get into our interview. Okay, so here we are. Tess Diamond, you want to take it away with the jobs?
Yeah, and before I introduce the jobs, we are also doing a special call-in portion of our show at the end of the show. If anybody has some questions for the Modern Farmer peeps, the number is, my mic is off, 518-828-0290. Again, that's 518-828-0290. That same old number from the pledge drive. All right, so jobs. Let's see. We have an assistant farm manager position in New Paltz for a small mixed vegetable farm operating two CSAs and going to one farmer's market. They also have laying hens and other small livestock. They're looking for someone to assist in all aspects of the vegetable growing and CSA management. This includes planting, weeding, harvesting, deliveries, and all other tasks. They'd prefer somebody with 1 to 2 seasons of experience who is available immediately, at least until the end of October. there is a monthly stipend. Housing, eggs, and vegetables are provided. If you're interested in that position, email Liller, L-I-L-I-R dot Rose at gmail.com. Again, that's L-I-L-I-R dot Rose, R-O-S-E at gmail.com. Let's see. We also have in Appleton, Maine, an immediate cheesemaking and goat husbandry apprentice at the award-winning Appleton Goat Cheese Dairy. This unique opportunity will allow you to experience the entire cycle from delivering kids to marketing the finished product at farmers markets. It's a 5-acre farm. They have daily cheese production, daily goat management, several weekly farmers markets, and a 50-goat herd. They're asking for a 6-month minimum commitment, and room and board is provided, plus $100 a week for a stipend. If you're interested in that, it's info at appletoncreamery.com. Info at Appleton, A-P-P-L-E-T-O-N, Creamery, C-R-E-A-M-E-R-Y.com. In Tivoli, close to here, Herman's Farm is looking for several apprentices for the coming farm season. They have over 100 acres of historic farmland. They have several acres of vegetable and flower production, 150 pastured laying hens, and 6 beehives. If you were to take this job, your responsibilities would include harvesting and processing, planting and transplanting, cultivation and irrigation of vegetables, weed and pest management, and livestock chores. The position is also paid, and if you're interested, contact Hannah, H-A-N-N-H-A-N-N-A-H, C-Beal, C-B-E-A-L, at gmail.com. Hannah C-Beal at gmail.com. And let's see, finally, in the job, oh no, there's 2 more jobs. In Concord, Massachusetts, a little bit far away, Gaining Ground Farm is looking for a full-time seasonal assistant farmer. They're a 5-acre nonprofit farm, and their mission is to grow organic food for hunger relief with the help of volunteers of all ages and abilities. They are asking for a 40-hour work week commitment, April through October. It'll include greenhouse work, transplanting, weeding, harvesting, doing some informal education. They'd like you to use the tractor and the rototiller. Basic carpentry and farm upkeep is good too. Pay is based on experience. If you're interested in that, the email is kaylee@gainingground.org. You spell Kaylee, K-A-Y-L-E-I-G-H, at gainingground.org. And lastly but not leastly, Hawthorne Valley Farm, Dreamboat Farm in Ghent, is looking for a creamery operations manager to join the team. It's a full-time position with benefits. The main responsibilities include overseeing the daily operation of the creamery, production scheduling, financial management, quality control, sanitation, assist with the expansion of the creamery into a new facility within 1 year. If you're interested in that, email Stefan, S-T-E-F-F-E-N, at hawthornvalleyfarm.org. And I also wanted to mention that the USDA Rural Development Grant workshops that are geared to give out information on loans, grants, and technical assistance that the USDA offers are happening on the 18th of April in Salisbury, Connecticut, and on the 25th in Hillsdale, New York. And you'll need to register for those. They're sponsored by the Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation, and you can find more information about those USDA Rural Development Grant workshops at berkshiretaconic.org.
Great. That sounds like great jobs.
Lots of jobs. Lots of things happening for the spring. Get in on the farming season now.
Yeah, this interested. Is the time. And also, I just got a little tap on my shoulder from one of the Modern Farmer crew, and they were saying that they are looking for some interns. I can't imagine what a dreamy situation that would be. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that job?
It's sort of like paradise on earth, I think, being our intern. We're looking for some good editorial and marketing interns. So you guys can get in touch with us by sending an email to edit, E-D-I-T, at modfarmer.com. Let's get some help in the office.
What would a daily activity be? If I was your intern, what would you say to me now?
I mean,
get us coffees,
probably non-fat lattes 3 times a day. No, I mean, I think it would be a really great internship for somebody interested to get into publishing, because we're a small operation. So I could imagine job tasks could run the gamut from, you know, sorting through old issues and helping us archive to reporting to fact checking to doing research. So
nice.
Cool. And is there a time frame for that, or is it just kind of a rolling application?
We're still sort of figuring that out. I think that probably we'll have interns seasonally, and I can imagine that some interns might come from colleges that are sort of bartering their time for a college credit. I know that happens a lot.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
That sounds great. Okay, so now we're in our news portion of the show, and I'm going to just read a few things. One, I want to start off with letting you know about something that we should all be aware of and even a little skeptical. There's kind of been a strange thing that's happened just on April 4th, where the meat industry is renaming beef, pork cuts, just before the U.S. grill season starts. So it's kind of, you know, maybe a money-making related move. I'm not quite sure.
Quite calculated, I'd say.
Quite calculated. But I'm going to read you a little excerpt from a report done by Elizabeth Campbell in Chicago from Bloomberg.com. Okay, here we go. The U.S. meat industry is renaming about 350 cuts of meat to make labels more consumer-friendly and less anatomically focused, marking the first major overhaul of industry nomenclature in 40 years. 2 years of consumer research by industry groups showed that the labeling... Sorry, I'm talking a little fast. Showed that the labeling of certain cuts in the grocery store were confusing to shoppers, said Trevor Amen, director of market intelligence for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association in Denver. Under the old naming model established in the 1970s, package labels were lengthy and anatomically based, he said. The changes are about eliminating some of those meat industry butcher terms that may be confusing or unappealing. Amen said in the telephone interview today, "We just really want to make it simplified for the consumer when they're shopping. For example, the cut of meat previously called the beef bottom round heel side boneless will be labeled Merlot steak under the new order. A pork loin center rib sliced bone-in will be called a ribeye roast. The new labeling recommendations include a common name first, such as porterhouse steak, followed by characteristics such as beef, loin bone-in, and then preparation instructions including grill for best results. Consumers may see the new labels in stores within the next several months," Amen said. "Meat demand tends to rise in the warm summer months of June, July, and August as consumers grill outdoors. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service and Agriculture Marketing Service were kept informed of the changes, and the USDA is definitely in support of this new standard because it should equate to more consumer-friendly names for the meat," says Sam Jones Ellard, a spokesman for the USDA. And our take on this is we have so many questions, like why are they simplifying our understanding of what we are eating? Or didn't we learn our lesson with the horse meat mislabeling in Europe last month? Do we actually think people want to know less about what they are eating? What's your take on this, Tess? Oh, she's in the middle of a little thing.
I agree with you completely, Elias.
Isn't it so strange?
Yeah, no, it's not fair. And I think I don't know if you said this, but it feels like they're trying to dumb down. We should know what the cuts are. We should absolutely try to be informed and try to figure out what we're eating at all times as much as we can. And to make it easier on us is you know, not presenting us with a challenge at all. So
yeah, let's challenge our minds. Like, what is a Merlot steak? That's so vague.
So vague. What okay. was it called before?
It was, I don't know. Oh. You know, I mean, it's whatever. I'll read you this little article later again.
Okay.
So, and on the Monsanto's Protection Act, I'm going to read a little excerpt from Doreen Hahn's report on Missouri's Monsanto Protection Act. Nothing says owned by Monsanto better than Missouri's HJR 7 and 11, Representative Jason Smith of Missouri, the Republican nominee for U.S. congressional seat of retired Representative Joanne Emerson, has put in a proposed constitutional amendment that would forever protect agricultural technology in Missouri. Most will recall the blunt admitted to allowing Monsanto to write the Monsanto Protection Act, and it recently passed. There's similar protected Monsanto bills in several other states during this spring legislative session, all being touted as right-to-farm bills. Those states are Delaware, Montana, Indiana, and Oklahoma. People concerned with healthy food choices and the continuation of family farms should get on their states' websites and make sure that this type of protection for Monsanto isn't progressing in their state. Here's the verbiage of the Missouri Protection Monsanto Bill as perfected. Section 23, that agriculture, which provides food, energy, health benefits, and security, is the foundation and stabilizing force of Missouri's economy. To protect this vital sector of Missouri's economy, the right of farmers and ranchers to engage in modern farming and ranching practices shall be forever guaranteed in this state. No state law shall be enacted which abridges the right of farmers and ranchers to employ agricultural technology and modern and traditional livestock production and ranching practices unless enacted by the General Assembly. Major concerns with this bill are that the factory farms and genetically modified foods of both animal and plant origins will proliferate in Missouri if this should pass through the legislature. Also, a deep concern is that the bill is being put forth to protect biotech corporations from being constrained in any way from their increasing control and market share in the agricultural realm. So get on your local government to protect your community from unhealthy farming practices. There was a great speech by Senator of Missouri John Tester to the House of Representatives on March 13th fighting this act. He also just happens to be maybe the only farming senator. Here is an excerpt from the press release about this speech. Senator John Tester today called out the House of Representatives for slipping corporate giveaways into a must-pass government funding bill designed to keep the government running past March 27th. Tester slammed the inclusion of two provisions that will hurt family farmers and ranchers while benefiting large meatpacking corporations and companies that develop genetically modified crops. Tester said backroom deals replaced open government and vowed to strip the provisions from the bill. These provisions are giveaways worth millions of dollars to a handful of the biggest corporations in the country and deserve no place in this bill, says Tester. Tester introduced two amendments to remove the controversial measures from the bill. The first provision gives large meatpacking corporations more power over the livestock market, while the second tells the U.S. Agriculture Department to ignore any judicial rulings that block the plantings of the crops that the court determines to be illegal. Tester, speaking on the Senate floor, said that the inclusion of the measures made a mockery out of Sunshine Week, which just happened to be the same week as when this was getting passed, when the federal government highlights the need for greater transparency and openness in government. Ha ha. Slipping corporate giveaways into a bill at the same time we call for more open government is doubling down on the same policies that created the need for Sunshine Week in the first place, Tester said. Sunshine Week shouldn't just be for show and tell. All right.
What do we say? We say right on, Tester.
Yeah, right on, Tester. Okay, so another little interesting tidbit is about the national animal ID systems that keep getting recommended for keeping track of our country's livestock. The plan is now withdrawn, but there is definitely government support to keep prodding to have these laws passed. Here is some information I pulled from farmandranchfreedom.org. Even though USDA bowed to public pressure and withdrew the plans, They still are relevant because there are many indications that agribusiness and high-tech companies plan to continue pushing for this sort of program piece by piece. And many of the same issues still arise, even with the new animal disease traceability program proposed by the USDA. The signatories of this position statement oppose the implementation, both in the state and federal level, of a mandatory national animal identification system. The NAIS would apply to every person who owns even one livestock animal or poultry, including horses, chickens, cows, goats, sheep, swine, turkeys, bison, elk, and deer. Each person would be required to register their property with the state, identify each animal with an internationally unique 15-digit number, and track events and report them to a government-accessible database within 24 hours. So it sounds like it would basically quadruple the size of work that you have to do with keeping any sort of livestock. The sole official purpose of this program is to provide 48-hour traceback of all animal movements in case of disease outbreak. Additionally, the government and industry organizations have urged the program as a means to improve the export market. While the USDA states that the program is currently voluntary at the federal level, it has been providing funds to the Senate to implement the program. With the encouragement of this federal funding, several states have implemented and proposed implementing mandatory programs. Moreover, several states have registered individuals in the program without their consent or by using coercive measures, while claiming that the program remains voluntary. Here's a little opinion by the reporter Lynn Miller. There is even word that the USDA is feeling the need to formally and legally end the recognition of hot branding of cattle in preference for ear tags and microchips. You can guess how that is going over across ranch lands. Follow the money trail, and it has long been easy to see that that a couple of companies stand to make a fortune if we farmers and ranchers require to purchase specialty identification markers and equipment. And these things will not prevent foodborne illness, nor will they clearly and regularly point out culpability. In our current system, many, if not most, of the meat animals change hands several times before appearing in pieces on the dining table. The lion's share of food safety issues come from processing, storage, and shipping, where traceability becomes difficult, if not impossible.
Well said, Lynn.
Nice, Lynn.
I think...
We got time for one more?
We have time for one more.
Okay. Well, the next one isn't really that super, you know, well, bat lovers around the world would find this super interesting, but there's not that many of those, but just so you know, bats are being threatened in 22 states of our country, many in the Northeast, possibly caused by people spreading bacteria exploring in the caves. Well, this is very much in the hypothesis stage of understanding, but bats have an important role in regulating insect population, a function that is vital to successful agriculture. A recent study found that the loss of North American bats could lead to agricultural losses of more than $3.7 billion this year. So let's keep an eye out for our white nose syndrome infected bats.
Does it say what to do when you find an infected bat?
I think you just should let you... I'll figure that out while you're giving the interview, and I'll get back to everyone.
Should we quarantine them? Should we just, you know, kill them?
I don't know. I think animal protection should be called.
Okay.
Check. ASAP.
Check. I saw some bats in a barn the other day in Hudson. I hope they weren't.
Did they have white noses?
It was unclear.
Okay.
It was dark. Scary. So we'll read a few eco updates from our favorite Acres mag before we talk to the modern farmer people. We were just joined by the senior editor, Andy Wright. We're very happy to have her in the studio. She's coming from San Francisco. So Hudson River sewage contamination. Can I already tell this is going to make us gag? Riverkeeper released its second report on sewage contamination in the Hudson River estuary. How is the water 2012? Detailing the ongoing widespread problem of sewage pollution in our local waterways. 24% of Riverkeeper samples taken from New York Harbor to Troy between 2006 and 2011 failed EPA guidelines for safe swimming. This is up from a failure rate of 21% for 2006 and 2010 and is three times greater than the 7% failure rate at beaches nationwide for the same time period. It's a bummer because we swim in the Hudson all the time. Let's hear about farm worker facilities. Farm workers are at potential risk from food and waterborne illnesses because of the condition of cooking and eating facilities available to them, according to a study from Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. Researchers evaluated cooking and eating facilities in migrant farm worker camps to compare against established housing regulations. They found that the facilities failed to comply with the regulations in a substantial number of camps. The study, which appears in the American Journal of Public Health, is part of an ongoing program of community-based participatory research at Wake Forest Baptist in conjunction with the NC Farm Workers Project and Student Action with Farm Workers. The researchers investigated the cooking and eating facilities and collected data from 182 farm worker camps in eastern North Carolina. Here's a prostate cancer risk linked to pesticides. According to the Pesticide Action Network, research published in the American Journal of Epidemiology shows that men exposed to certain agricultural pesticides are more likely to develop aggressive forms of prostate cancer. This news confirms earlier findings linking pesticide exposure with this type of cancer, which is the third most common cause of cancer death rate among males. The study looked at exposure data from the Agricultural Health Study and cancer incidence information from the state registries. The numbers show that the workers in Iowa and North Carolina exposed to certain pesticides had significantly higher prostate cancer risk. The AHS was a long-term study that tracked lifetime usage of pesticides among licensed pesticide applicators between 93 to 2007. Want to share some news?
Sure. Okay. So here's one about exposure to pesticides increasing diabetes risk. A study conducted at the University of Granada has revealed that there is a direct relationship between exposure to persistent organic pollutants in food, air, and water and prevalence of type 2 diabetes in adults regardless of age, gender, and body mass index. These substances tend to concentrate in body fat, and they might be one of the reasons why obese people are more likely to develop diabetes. Since the more fat, the higher the POP concentrations in the body. In a paper recently published in the journal Environmental Research, researchers demonstrate that people with higher concentrations of DDE, the main metabolite in the pesticide DDT, are four times more likely to develop type 2 diabetes than other people. In addition, the risk of type 2 diabetes is also associated with exposure to BHCH. I won't even try and pronounce the long word that links to, but you can call me and ask and I'll write you an email, which is present in the formula of the pesticide Lindano. So basically another reason to eat well and local.
To watch the organic pesticides.
Yes.
Okay, I think this is a good time to probably transition into chatting with the modern farmer people. They're all sharing one mic, so it's going to be a little tricky. Hopefully you can hear them.
Yeah, be sure to put your mouth right up to the microphone when you decide to use it.
Let's remind our listeners that if you'd like to call in and ask the modern farmer people who are now coming out of their bat cave of hibernation for their magazine release, you can call 518-828-0290. That's our WGXC line, 518-828-0290. And we'll try to figure out how to pick up the phone. So again, we're joined by Rehan, Jake, and Andy. Rehan is the deputy editor. Andy is the senior editor. And Jake is the web content editor. Is that?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds
okay.
Great.
Okay, cool. So we're curious just to start on the macro level. Can you tell us a little bit about the story and the evolution of Modern Farmer?
Sure.
This is Rehan speaking.
Hi. Our founder, Anne-Marie Gardner, has lived in Hudson Valley for, I think, around 11 years. And she began working on this concept, I think, like 3 years ago. And I think that when she talks about it, it was because she's living in this extremely agricultural area, having conversations with farmers, and she would travel for work. She was working for Monocle magazine and the New York Times magazine to Egypt, Argentina, etc., and she found people were having the exact same conversations about where does my food come from, do you know your farmer, you know, how can we make sure our food supply is safe, etc. And so that inspired her to put together a business proposal, and Modern Farmer came into being officially, I think, last November.
Great.
Nice.
So she established the team last November, and you guys have been working on the issue.
Yes.
Wow.
And how long have you all been in the Hudson Valley?
Andy and I showed up here in November. Jake joined us in January. I moved here from San Francisco, and Jake came from Los Angeles, although he's going to stay anchored in Brooklyn. And then Andy is our West Coast presence. She's going to stay in San Francisco.
Great.
Well, the farming community is huge in California, too. Do you think that you're going to have a linking between the East Coast and West Coast? We know that you have like the international kind of reporting that's happening already in your magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Andy speaking, by the way. When I first was keyed into this project, I was really excited about it from the start. And I thought it was really important. I think we all thought it was really important to have a presence in California. California, my statistics might not be current, but I think that California produces like half of the nuts, fruits, and vegetables mm-hmm. in the country. There's over 80,000 farms and ranches. There's so many people working in that industry. And so it just seems really important not just to be in California, but also San Francisco, where there's a very strong interest in urban agriculture.
Mm-hmm. And is a lot of your content in California, for example, that does house some really gigantic farms. Are you focusing on farms like that? Are you focusing on small farms? Is it sort of, are you trying to breach all?
I think that we're interested in telling stories about all kinds of agriculture, but you'll find that a lot of the stories in our first issue are focused on small farms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned that Anne-Marie was living in, I guess she, where was she living? In Tivoli or?
Germantown.
In Germantown, okay. And she's an international lady. I know that she's been all over the place reporting. I'm curious to know why she decided to set up her offices in Hudson.
Well, she loves Hudson Valley, for starters. And also, I think it just made sense. I mean, we're, you know, a media company covering food and farming, and this is such a rich area in both things. Also, I think it's interesting that, you know, these days you could have a staff that works from a lot of different locations. So I think that, you know, thanks to Google Hangout, we can be a lot of different places at once.
Do you guys use Google Hangout?
We do. We actually...
Oh, like as a staff?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't want to give Google Hangout too much credit since it usually quits in the middle of a meeting, but...
It does have really cool special effects.
Yeah, we can add noises and little masks when we're talking to each other, which is pretty key to our process. Yeah.
And what? And going back to this sort of international focus that really was striking to everybody that I've showed the magazine to, what do you guys have people in other countries that are sort of reporting for you? How are you culling your stories?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we, from the get-go, were really committed to being global, and I think that's one of the things that attracted all of us to the project was the possibility of, you know, I think a lot of agriculture gets told through like regional or even national lenses. So Anne-Marie had a lot of writer contacts. We have a really great photo director who also found us photographers in, you know, gosh, like 4 or 5 continents. So, you know, we get pitches, we solicit pitches, and then we would get kind of like someone would suggest a place to us and we'd look into it and then try to find a reporter that you know, was based in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody did want to report for you or if somebody had an idea for you, how would they approach you about that?
They should email us. We have a shared editorial address that's edit@modfarmer.com. I think... we've put out a few calls before we launched on our Tumblr for stories, and we've gotten a really good response. So we're excited.
Mm. We've also been interested, because I remember when we spoke before, you were mentioning that you want to, at some point, not only have this in newsstands, but also have it at like the Tractor Supply and various other places to have it be accessible to farmers and also other people who are just like generally interested in farming, maybe as a consumer of healthy foods, or who do you see as your actual demographic or like who your audience is with this magazine?
We've been thinking about it in the broadest possible terms. So we think anyone who cares about where their food comes from could be a modern farmer reader. To that end, we're going to be distributed in Barnes & Noble, Whole Foods, Hudson News, and also Tractor Supply. But I think that for the print magazine, one of the things we're most excited about is we've been brokering relationships with CSAs. So we're hoping that we can find subscribers who literally their point of contact with farmers. We've also kind of been exploring, you know, going to farmers markets. So hopefully we're going to reach people where they're actually interacting with farmers as consumers.
I have a question, just going a little bit back to the evolution of Modern Farmer. You know, there have been really gorgeous food magazines around for a long time, and this is really the first farming-centric magazine that I've seen. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, really how you see your focus on farmers, on people who are actually in the field day-to-day, and what kinds of resources you offer them, and how practical you think, you know, are things that you're covering are for those farmers? And
yeah, I mean, I think that we see a lot of great food magazines and websites out there, and we're not trying to replicate their efforts. So we're really kind of more looking at food, like the, you know, the story behind it getting to your plate, not kind of culinary aspects of food. I think that, you know, we're trying to make it accessible to people who are aspiring farmers, but relevant for people who farm for, you know, as their sole income. So we have a how-to section in the print magazine. We're calling it the handbook. That kind of is more of a guide for less experienced farmers, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then we're trying to, you know, tell really great stories from farming around the world. I think also it's important to say that, like, we want to have fun. Like, we don't think that, you know, farmers don't have a sense of humor. Right. And especially on the website, I think we're going to be trying to keep the tone, you know, just super serious stories, but also, you know, baby animals, baby farm animals.
Which I caught a rumor that there's going to be maybe a baby goat at your release party.
Yeah, we can't confirm that.
It's a rumor still.
All right. All right.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed I noticed that there were a few people I recognized from the area, like Mark Firth from the Berkshires and Sam Levin also. But do you feel that in the next few issues you're going to focus on things that are more Hudson Valley centric? Is that is it just kind of up in the air at this point?
I think we're always happy to feature people from our area, but I don't think we're ever going to be regionally focused. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of like written into our sort of mission to, you know, think about agriculture as broadly as possible.
Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at the magazine now, and I don't know if this is a question as much as it's a compliment, actually, but it's the layout is really sexy and really beautiful, and it looks like any kind of modern magazine that you know, is diverse and has stories about fashion and culture and architecture. But was that, you know, but you really, there are some hard-hitting articles in here. Like, there's a great article about slaughterhouses, and the title of the article is pretty provocative. It says, "This is what humane slaughter looks like. Is it good enough?" And I'm curious, you know, it seems that that's maybe a tactic to sort of pull in people to really get engaged with real conversations about food. These are kind of things I'm talking to farmers about all the time, and soil health you talk about, and you know, the DIY stuff is really critical. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, thank you. Because that is really what we were trying to do, you know, kind of give people a good mix of stories. And, you know, I think that the aesthetic is something that Anne-Marie really led us on. And I think it looks gorgeous. And we were also lucky to have a great design firm. So we are blessed.
And then how do you feel about your relationship to other similar broad-topicked magazines like the Small Farmers Journal or Acres Magazine? Just because you are covering so many different topics, and it's not like you're just like a specialty sheep or like just a culinary or just, you know, it's like really about lifestyle and understanding a broad idea.
Well, we really, really like them. We're big fans, you know. I think that you know, they do great work. And, you know, it's funny. We actually, Anne-Marie took a lot of inspiration from a lot of older farming magazines also. Like there was this great farming magazine from the 50s called Rustica that was produced in France and completely in French. So I actually couldn't read any of the stories. but it looked really cool. And I think that we kind of want to be practical, but also show people like beautiful places you want to go to.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Was there anything else specific that we want? I know that we had a few
things we wanted. Well, I think it'd also be good to talk to, I mean, so this is in the press release I read that it's a media platform, and that seems to encompass a lot of different things. It's the print publication. It's also e-commerce, right? There's some stuff in the magazine that's for sale, stuff online that's for sale. But maybe Jake could speak a little bit to what the website looks like, what kind of resources are on that, how it evolved differently maybe from the magazine, or what your plans are for the website.
I would like to keep talking.
Okay. Sorry.
Just kidding.
I apologize to Rehan first.
What a radio voice Jake has.
Yeah, great timber. So the website is actually up. We launched on very late on Wednesday night, and we've been up for a couple of days now. If you go to modernfarmer.com right now, you can see a good selection of what we'll be running. The website is going to be, I mean, on the basic level, we're going to be trying to do 3 to 5 new stories every day. And some of that is just going to be taking stuff from the magazine and putting it up. And then a lot of it's going to be, we're commissioning web-only pieces. You know, we have a great, great story by writer Peter Smith, who went to the orange groves of Florida and is sort of on the hunt for this orange blight that right now is sort of decimating the orange groves of Florida. It's weird. It's gorgeous. It's a very odd story in the best possible way. And it's something that we were doing online. We're also going to have a great article that went up today that's just an advice column from a writer, Manjula Martin, and her dad, Oren. And it just says, you know, how do I know if my soil sucks or not? So we're going to be doing that. We also want to have e-commerce up. We don't currently have a store up and running, but we will shortly. We'll be selling stuff for the Modern Farmer. We also want to make it into a resource for farmers. So one thing that we're working on right now is we heard so many great stories from farmers about their sort of first year of farming and mm-hmm. how they would have basically catastrophes on the farm. We heard one about somebody who basically was trying to do an urban bee farm in San Francisco and released a swarm of bees down Valencia Street, which is a really crowded urban corridor. Lots of stories about escaped goats, just ways. So in that way, we want farmers to be able to talk to a wider audience. We also hope that farmers are able to sort of talk to other farmers on the website. And it's all being done with, if you go to the website right now, and please do, because we're looking at page views very closely, you'll see we're doing it with the same sort of really gorgeous aesthetic that we have in the magazine.
Mm-hmm. Can you, and Rehan, is it true, I think that you, are you a staff writer also? Are you writing some of the articles in here?
Yeah, I mean, Andy wrote some of the articles. Anne Marie's written articles. We all write articles.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about your favorite articles, or any? Are there any like really good stories about the reporting that we should that will excite us even more to buy the magazine?
That is a really good question. I did an interview with this photographer, Alex McLean. Who is an aerial photographer, and I found him utterly charming, and his photographs are gorgeous. He's been an airplane pilot and photographer for, gosh, like 30 years now, and he just said a lot of fascinating things about what he's seen kind of looking at, you know, America's farmland from above, and he's seen a lot of it change. Like, he can see when like small farms get bought out and bigger places move in, and he's seen that change over time. I thought that was really interesting. I'm very, very partial to a story done by our new staff writer, Jesse Hirsch, who is moving here also, but is not here right now, about the epidemic, the scourge of feral pigs. It's a worldwide problem, and there is really no solution, and those pigs are crazy.
What's happening? The Asaba?
No, it's not just one breed. It's just kind of like across the world, there's been this explosion in the wild boar population, and they're moving into urban areas, and pigs are so smart. Like, these guys are, like, unkillable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm.
They're literally radioactive.
And so strong.
Oh, they're so strong. Like, if you, like, Jesse found, from talking to people, you know, asking, like, what's the best way to handle this overpopulation? And they were like, well, you know, it's you can kill more pigs by shooting them from helicopters, but that's very expensive. But even then, if you miss, the pigs learn very quickly the sound of the helicopters, and they will flatten themselves out on the ground.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
I know. It's crazy.
Wow.
Amazing.
So, and then you guys are all coming from, like, pretty hard-hitting publications. I know you mentioned Anne Marie is coming from Monocle and The Times. And what are your backgrounds in the publication world?
I was a staff writer at the San Francisco Chronicle for 5 or so years. And then I've worked at an online news outlet called The Bay Citizen, where actually Andy and I work together. We represent the culture desk at The Bay Citizen. And my last job was at BuzzFeed. Jake can speak to his background.
I was at LA Weekly before coming here. And before that, I was at San Francisco Weekly, SF Weekly. And then I also spent time at Wired and Business 2.0 and various Silicon Valley startups.
Right. So, there. So no, like, really necessarily agriculture-centric, farming-centric, even necessarily food-centric. But coming from these places, and certainly the Bay Area and the Hudson Valley are these little bastions of this kind of stuff. So we know about food and we're versed in all these the terminology. But were you shocked or surprised when this subject came up, when Anne Marie was excited about making a beautiful new magazine about, you know, that's titled Modern Farmer for sort of the everyman?
Yes. Yeah. Through friends, I met Anne Marie. And when she approached me, I was like, you know what? You could talk to so many Bay Area food journalists. I know 50. I'm not one of them. I've been covering technology and culture for a long time. But I was really impressed by her vision for it, because it really was, you know, there are so many great food magazines, and it's a community that is so vocal and opinionated. And if you're an outsider, it can be a little bit intimidating if you don't have an opinion on stuff, you know? And I feel like with Modern Farmer, we're approaching it very much from, like, a little bit as outsider journalists. And I hope that that ends up being good, because I think people that are not necessarily, you know, who have not been living the farming lifestyle for years can pick it up and get something out of it.
Yeah, it's. I think it's so cool because it's really developing the lexicon for everybody to kind of start really having in-depth conversations.
Yeah, I think a lot of times our starting point for articles is, what don't we know? Like, what don't we know? What do we want to know? And, you know, a lot of our writers and our contributing editor, for instance, is this woman, Twilight Greenaway, who is extremely knowledgeable at the terrain, and she was incredibly valuable to us by educating us on a lot of kind of the nuances of the issues. But I always want us to be coming from a very, like, a curious, questioning place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to be curious and not feel like you're uninvited to ask questions and be a novice.
Right. Totally.
What was the name of the, what was that term that you used earlier that you really liked for, like, a consumer or, like, a alternative?
Well, like, I like to call Elise and I agrarian sympathizers, because although I do manage a farm, I wouldn't consider myself a hardcore farmer. And, you know, we are.
And I'm just, and I'm a carpenter.
And Elise is a carpenter.
Yeah.
But we've both worked on farms, and we're both quite involved with our local farms and our local farmers. And I think, yeah, I like that term. Like, I'm an agrarian sympathizer. I really, like, want to know about all of it. And I'm curious and can't think of more important issues than being involved with local food and trying to figure out where your food's sourced from and the impacts of our industrialized agriculture system.
And you don't always need to be the one who's actually digging in the dirt. Also, just, like, transportation to the city to sell the food, or, you know, there's so many different roles that people play within the economy of food.
And so many potential roles. I mean, there's so much room for growth and so much room for innovation and so much room for change. And again, I think that's, like, what's nice about a publication like this is it's sort of making it universal and making it accessible, which is really, really critical for conversation, I think.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Really helpful. Oh, I have two more things that I want to say before we sign off and listen to our song. But okay. first it's...
Is there anything else you guys want to yeah. say about... Is there anything that you want to share, Andy? You haven't spoken much, or Jake, or, you know, just opening it up. This is your chance to talk to the community.
Well, that's what I'm known for around the office, is being really quiet.
Sorry, not to put you on the spot.
I'm a very reserved person. Yeah, I don't know.
That's not what I saw at the Iron Horse.
That's not cool. What happens at the Iron Horse should stay at the Iron Horse.
True. I'll see you Thursday.
I guess I can pile on and talk a little bit about my favorite stories in the magazine. For me personally, the one that I enjoyed reporting was talking to this romance writer out of Australia. There is this entire genre of romance writing in Australia called rural romance, and they're romance novels written by women who are actually farmers, and they're all about farmers and women, and she was just such a badass, and
nice.
She's cool, and I felt really lucky to talk to her and kind of like stumble on this genre that I don't think is...
They fiction stories?
They are fiction stories,
yeah. Oh,
wow, yeah.
Cool.
And it hasn't made its way to the United States, but I feel like it's only a matter of time. And then the other thing in the magazine that I really love is this kind of quirky ode to a hardware store. So every issue is going to have like a love letter to a different kind of hardware store.
Oh, wow.
And
that's
we have
an
this really wonderful piece about a French hardware store called... I'm going to butcher it, but I think it's Leroy Marlon.
It's good enough.
Tell me you've been to Rogerson's in town here. Have you been to Rogerson's, the hardware store?
Yes. Oh, we love Rogerson's.
So much good back stock and American made. Man.
Yeah, I know. It's my dream just to go explore every single floor in that place. It's so amazing.
Yes. But I wanted to do a couple other shout outs before we sign off. And one is the community garden in Hudson is about to be starting up, building out, and we're going to be organizing some events. So keep your ear to the streets about what's happening at the community garden. It's getting warm and we need to get these seeds started.
We're going to be doing some education programs. I want to start a community dye garden, if anybody knows more about that than I do.
Oh, I got that for you.
Oh, cool. But yeah, the community garden's a great thing to get involved with here in Hudson.
Also, the Greenhorns, we're now almost at the point where our new Young Farmer's Almanac is coming out. It should be out and printed in about 2 weeks. So if you're wanting to order that, go to greenhorns.net. But again, thank you so much here with Modern Farmer Magazine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And look for their magazine on newsstands starting the 16th.
15th or 16th?
Oh, sorry.
We can't seem to... nail that down.
Oh, well. Yeah. And if you happen to be in the city anytime after the 14th, there is a newsstand opening up that will have a lot of radical news. It's called Petrella's Imports. You can come and visit me there at Canal and Bowery, and we will be hosting the Modern Farmer magazine, and along with some awesome. Greenhorns publications.
Cool. That's great. Thanks so much. This is the Ag Show signing off.
A mighty hard road that my poor hand is hoed. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rolled, and your desert was hot and your mountains was cold. I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground in the light of your moon. On the edge of your city you've seen us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind. California and Arizona, I make all your crops, and it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine, to set on your table your light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that grand coulee dam where the water runs down. Ever stayed in this union, us migrants have been. We'll work in this fight and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble, that river and I, all along your green valley I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it be, cause my pastures of plenty must always be free.
Black girl, black girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In a pond, where the sun never shine, I will shiver all night through. Black girl, where will you go? I'm gone where the cold wind blows. In a pond, where the sun never shine, I will shiver night too. Black girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pond, where the sun never shine, I wish you were all night too. My husband was a railroad man, killed a mile and a half from here. His head was found in a driver's wheel, and his body haven't been found. Black girl, where will you go? I'm gone where the cold wind blows. You caused me to weep, and you caused me to moan. You caused me to